This is On the Other Hand. A podcast sponsored by Braber Angels in Arkansas that explores politics and other issues of importance to Arkansans through conversations with community leaders. Stay with us as we talk to another leader in Arkansas who works across differences to get things done and to bring us closer together.
Hello and welcome to On the Other Hand. I'm your host, Glenn White. I'm here with my co-host, April Chatham Carpenter. On our podcast, as you know, April and I interview community leaders in Arkansas who help work towards solutions across various political or other divides, or who in other ways reach across various divisions within our community. We also, on occasion, feature subject matter experts, and that is the case today. So, April, tell us about our guest.
Yeah, Glenn. Today, we're going to have the privilege of talking with Dr. Blake Perkins. Dr. Perkins has a PhD in history from West Virginia University. He's currently the Associate Vice Chancellor for Academics and an Associate Professor of History at Arkansas State University, Beebe. And we came across Blake's work because of his research on the life of what he calls Ozarkers during the late 1800s to the mid-1900s. And in his work, he has focused on the impact of divisions between rural and town people and between small farmers and businessmen. When, you know, the rural-urban divide has become, I think, even a wider divide nationally, and there's research to show that it can lead to political polarization. So we wanted to have Blake on to talk about his work. We originally came across his work in a recent article by Bill Bowden in the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, and realized that there were some interesting implications that might shed light on this particular source of current political division and in our state in particular. So we're going to learn more about his research, Glenn. We're going to discuss some possible ways that his analysis of Ozarkers might help shed some light on current controversies in the state, including the recent discussion about changing the status of the Buffalo River, which has been a point of contention with folks in that area. So welcome to On the Other Hand, Blake.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
Well, we always start out with our guests by having them tell a little bit about themselves, maybe a brief bit about their early life and how it led to their current career and your current positions at ASU Beebe. So tell us what you would like to have our listeners know about you and your early kind of where you are to where you came from.
Okay. Yeah. So, as you mentioned, I'm a history professor and academic administration at ASUBB now. I've been working in higher ed, teaching college level history for more than 10 years now. I have to add them up, but I've been in this business for quite some time. I am a native Arkansan. I grew up on a fifth generation cattle farm along the Strawberry River near Smithville in western Lawrence County, and actually our farm crossed the county line over to Sharp County. So that's the area that I'm from, and family's got deep roots in the Ozarks foothills there, and even before that up in Missouri, the Missouri Ozarks as well. So grew up there. We raised cattle and harvested hay and that kind of thing. My mother was a U.S. postal worker. I had all kinds of different jobs. She actually just retired from that less than a year or so ago. So I always lived in a small town, really out on the farm in a small town there. Went to a very small public high school, Lynn. It was in the Lynn School District at that time. And I graduated there in 2004. The following year, due to the Lakeview case and then Governor Mike Huckabee's plan for addressing that, the district was forced to consolidate, and so it's now Hillcrest School District there. And I still live in that area. I live in Lynn actually. And actually serve on the school board there at Hillcrest. But went to school there at Lynn. And then from there, I went to Lyon College in Batesville and majored in history there. And from Lyon College, I went to Missouri State University and worked with Ozarks historian Brooks Blevins, who's written many, many books about articles about the Ozarks. He's kind of the scholar on the Ozarks. And so, and then from there, I went to West Virginia University for my PhD in history, and really studied kind of the rural South and rural Appalachia, especially the upland South there at West Virginia. And so I came back to Arkansas actually before I finished my doctorate and began teaching at Williams Baptist University in Walnut Ridge, which is my home county. And I taught there and chaired the history department, history and political science department there for, oh, I guess, 8 or 9 years before I took this position. So that's a little bit about who I am and where I came from. So,
well, thank you for sharing that. I always think about you know, how as professors we tend to study things sometimes that are near and dear to our heart, and it sounds like that being raised in rural Arkansas and small town Arkansas might have been some of the impetus for your getting interested in studying that. Would you say that's true for you?
It is, and you know, I should mention too that I mean, I grew up around both my maternal and paternal grandparents, knew them well, and I mean, they were always just part of our life, you know, just the extended family there. And I even got to know 7 of my 8 great grandparents, who were all within about a probably 7 or 8 mile radius of everyone there. So yeah, that definitely my interest in their lives, stories they would tell. I mean, that's what really drew me to history. No doubt about that.
Great that you spent time getting to know some of those generations and getting to hear their stories. Well, I would love for you, for our listeners, just to describe some key high points that you've been finding in your research on rural urban differences in Arkansas, just a few, and then we'll probably go into, you know, some more of them, into the little bit of the weeds of them as we ask additional questions. So,
okay. Yeah. So, in 2017, University of Illinois Press published my book, Hillbilly Hellraisers, as part of its Working Class in American History series. And that really was a revised version of my doctoral dissertation work there. But it really looks at several, you might call them case studies, from the late 1800s, on into the middle of the 1900s, in which rural Ozarkers were encountering various programs of kind of government authority, government power, and so forth, and resisting those in some form or another. And so so that's what the book is about. And so it's got there's a chapter, for instance, on of course, stereotypes, right? That's one of the big themes of the book, is challenging stereotypes. These kinds of simplistic depictions that many people have of rural hill folks as, you know, being kind of backward, out of step, the other, right? Not really in line with the rest of America, at least modern America. And one of those, I guess, sub stereotypes of kind of that image is that rural hill folks have always been, you know, obstinately defiant and opposed to anything that smacks of government, right? So that's one of the things I was looking at. And you know, in each of these cases, at first glance, it does appear, right, that they are resisting the feds and different arms of the U.S. government, but digging deeper, as we historians do, into the facts and getting to know the people through the documentary record as best we can, which is sometimes challenging, of course, when you're trying to document rural folks who didn't necessarily leave diaries and journals and write letters to one another, that kind of thing. But digging in, though, I mean, I found that this is much more complex, as we all are, right? as human beings. We're complex. There were real rational reasons behind a lot of their opposition. And in fact, one of the themes that I discovered, at least since the earlier part of the book there, was that resistance to federal government wasn't always really resistance to, Washington, D.C. It was often local conflict playing out, kind of at that level, and really often a very rural versus town divide. And of course the towns and the more well-to-do, influential folks had the levers of government, that they were working there, and often perhaps against the interests of the rural folks out on the farms and that kind of thing. And so there's a chapter about, for instance, the moonshiners, and unfortunately a deadly incident that I zero in on in 1897, which there was a shootout between some small farmers there distilling moonshine, and the and federal marshals that attempted to raid and shut them down there. There's also a chapter in there on some rural resistance to some early USDA, progressive agriculture programs, and even some, surprisingly to some perhaps, but major draft resistance among rural folks during World War One. That's another chapter. So anyway, just kind of like I said, just kind of some case studies that I really zero in on, and you might call micro histories. We kind of put the microscope over it and zoom in, and to really see what's going on, try to dig beneath those stereotypes. So that's really what the book is about, and kind of what my research is really kind of focused on, even since then. So
thank you for that, Blake. Before we go any further, because I'm going to ask you a couple of questions in some depth about some of the local issues that may relate to what we're talking about. But since you're a historian, it occurs to me, a lot of us don't have maybe at best a vague notion of what historians do. And I wonder if, and I think about that quote, which I think is some version of something that Santayana said. It says basically, if we don't learn from history, we risk repeating our mistakes. So I wonder if you could just kind of give us a little quick Reader's Digest defense of what a historian does, and what the study of history, how we can use that for the betterment of our society.
Yeah. Okay. Sure. So yeah, I mean, most academics would clarify that, history never really truly repeats itself, right? You can never really repeat, like a scientific experiment or something, all of the conditions that, you can never really replicate that in any given time. But yeah, I mean, there are patterns. I mean, really, history is the study of human beings, right? And human nature, and they're real life examples. And so historians, of course, we're tethered to the facts and what's available to us in the documentary record. But historical research, historical thinking, kind of opens a window to us to, draw connections, right, between our own times such and such happened. That's similar, right? So we can learn from that and help guide us. Now, historians are certainly not fortune tellers, and most of us would humbly admit that. There's no way we can, again, because history never really truly repeats itself, so no way we can really predict the future or anything like that. But there, we can certainly offer some insights into patterns, and just context is important, right? Why things happened the way they did, instead of these simplistic kinds of ideas that we may have or assumptions that we may have. So historians are about really digging in and searching for the truth as best as it can be found in the documentary record.
Yeah, and I appreciate very much that you say that historians really focus on facts, information that can be vetted and have some confidence in, because how us human beings are, we can spread rumors and conspiracy theories and the whole bit. So I really appreciate that. So as a subject matter expert here that we're talking about, in the same way that April was mentioning, we're thinking your research and writings about Ozarkers can help us understand something that we focus on in our work with Braver Angels, which is trying to reduce political polarization, usually between what we call reds and blues. In your writing, you talk about Ozarkers being skeptical of outsiders in some fashion. The research that we know about political polarization in general, it includes a strong dose of how we all are social animals. And as social animals, then we're predisposed to form into groups and to adopt strong emotional attachment to our group's ideas and norms. Your research describes how rural Arkansans, Ozarkers, as a group, often display suspicion toward, now, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but from what I'd read, it sounded like one area of skepticism is, you know, people of wealth, people from more urban areas, or just people from outside their home area. So does that, is that at least partially true? Is that about right? Did I get that?
Yeah, I think so. You know, in my work, I'm particularly focusing on what I refer to, and many historians refer to, as kind of the populist era there. The late 1800s rolls over into the early 1900s. And that's an era, of course, you know, in broader American history, many textbook chapters and so forth would, you know, call that the Gilded Age, right? Term that Mark Twain had coined there, that, you know, kind of, it seemed on the outside to be an era of growing prosperity and wealth and just forward marching, right, in the American nation. But digging beneath that, you know, the gilded outer layer, things weren't maybe quite so shiny. And so I think that's the context we see here in a place like the rural Ozarks, and not just the rural Ozarks, but other rural areas as well. It was an era in which the pressures began to really mount on small farmers. You know, and by you know, that's kind of a definition to something I've kind of grappled with on that. But by small farmers, I'm really referring to a farm in which, for the most part, the labor is done by the family unit, right? Not really hiring out others for labor, not really using a wage type system, but family members doing the labor and so forth. So anyway, it became more difficult. You know, railroads, for example, that was one of the things that a lot of rural Ozarkers, a lot of rural people in general throughout America, had been really excited about, right? These railroads coming, all these promises made that, hey man, this is going to open new opportunities for us, marketing our crops and that kind of thing. And it did, but it also, in many ways, caused kind of some centralization of some markets there that didn't always turn out so well for the smaller farmers, kind of on the lower end of the totem pole, you might say. And also things like they began to face railroad rates that, wow, we weren't expecting this, right? I mean, this is going to bite too far into our income and the way we support our family. And so that's just an example, I guess. And so to your point about, you know, suspicion of people with money, I think that's really right on. I mean, the suspicion that began to arise with a lot of truth to it, that people with money have the best access to political power and gaining the resources to implement new changes and programs and such. And I mean, I think many rural Ozarkers felt like, well, you know, they're doing this, you know, they're saying this is going to be best for the entire region, but really it's just kind of more, it's best for them. Town folks, business folks, larger farmers, you know, who did employ, you know, wage hands and that kind of thing. And so that was, I think, one of the big things that, again, kind of led to a bit of a political revolt in Arkansas and some other rural places. So, I mean, I think that's part of it. You know, you mentioned the outsiders, the suspicion of outsiders. That's, I think probably a bit overblown in some of the stereotypes. I mean, that's one of the big, that rural mountain folks are, innately suspicious of outsiders. I think there's a grain of truth to that, again, because their experiences often with outsiders, or those same experiences we're talking about, the outside people and resources that come in and often change things, and they end up with the short end of the stick. And so I think, I think there's, again, some rational, some logic to that. But there were instances as well of outsiders coming in who put down roots. They worked hard to fit in with the communities, respected the communities that they were now living in, and I mean, they in some cases became key leaders, of those communities. I'm thinking of one person in particular. His name was Isaac McCracken. He was actually a Canadian. Had been born in Canada and grew up in New England. Worked on some whaling ships as a young man, and then had migrated, I think, to Minnesota, and ended up, anyway, found his way down to Arkansas, the Ozarks, northwestern Arkansas, by the 1880s or so. And he ended up becoming key leader of some of those local political movements that were starting there. Very well respected in that movement. And it's again, he's one of those that we don't have, there's no diary or journal or anything to really know exactly what was going through his mind and how he did things and that kind of thing. But from what we have available to us, documentary record, he really invested himself in the community. Respected the small farmers around him, and really made them feel like he was kind of one of them, right? And developed that bond of trust. So anyway, my point is, there are examples of outsiders coming in and really,
I
defining
think
experience.
I think that's probably true with any group you can look at. There's both the truth of some inherent suspicion, but also the truth that you have a lot of things working toward you being accepting of outsiders till they prove themselves, wrong otherwise. But I want to move on to something else. I want to kind of go into a couple of things that we read in the article where you were quoted extensively. So let me read this first quote, and then I'll ask you to help us understand how what you're talking about there might be applied in a current controversy. Right now, as you know, we have a bit of a controversy in our state over the status of the Buffalo River. Is it going to maintain the way it is and has been, or is it going to change from like a, I believe it's a from a national park to a national preserve is one of the main conversations. I think it would be helpful in our better appreciating all the factors that can lead us to dismiss ideas, that come from someone else simply because they're not consistent with our tribe's views. If we can learn some things from that, that will help us make better decisions and how to avoid being misled or manipulated by folks who don't necessarily have our group's interests in mind. So let me read this quote from the article and then I'll ask you to comment on it. For now, historical perspective would seem to suggest that local families in the Ozarks who are sincerely interested in rural living and in protecting the land and river for future generations ought to be carefully mindful of what interests are indeed at stake and who's pushing in what direction and for what reason. They should work diligently to maintain healthy checks and balances in such coalitions because interests with more money and resources can have a tendency to run away with the ball and suddenly leave their teammates standing in the dust. And they need to recognize real allies and keep them close, even if they look, talk, live, or otherwise do things a little differently than they do. So, can you help us unpack, what you're thinking there and how it might apply to our current controversy over the Buffalo River status?
And I think, I mean, as a historian, I'll maybe give a couple of historical examples. It really came to mind when I gave that quote there. I mean, to your point, I think it's very important for people to really, dig in and and learn about what's going on, who's involved, and you know, as much as possible, what's going on, what's at stake, right? I mean, in these kinds of cases. And so, but yeah, I mean, I think there are instances, are cases in which, you know, the more powerful groups can be pretty clever with their rhetoric and with, you know, making it sound like, hey, we're one of you, and this is our, yeah, as you said, this is our tribe here, right? And really kind of fashioning this kind of my team versus that team over there. I'll just give you a good example of going back to the late 1800s, early 1900s. There, I think part of what really, a big part of what really defeated at least the political coalitions that were forming for what became known as the populist movement, that I think genuinely threatened the overthrow of the established at that time Democratic Party in power in Arkansas and throughout the South. Part of what really defeated that possibility was how many rural whites began to, and often prompted and encouraged by, again, rhetoric and things they read in the press that were pushing a certain agenda and so forth. They often began to really fail to recognize the similarities that they had with fellow rural blacks, for instance. I mean, they in a whole lot of ways. I mean, obviously, rural whites were not, you know, segregated against, discriminated against in the kinds of ways rural blacks were. But economically speaking, and so as far as conditions on farm and you know, trying to support families and that kind of thing. In so many ways, they were in the same boat. These small rural white farmers and small rural black farmers. But as this, you know, really tribal rhetoric, a lot of it referenced, of course, the old Confederacy and the horrors of Reconstruction, right? I mean, they were, a lot of the opposition, you know, really played up that kind of rhetoric. Again, that tried to sort of using that kind of tribal rhetoric, and it often worked. It worked. It turned a lot of rural whites off. Well, you know, I don't know about that. And a great example of that, you know, was the election in 1900 of Governor Jeff Davis in Arkansas. He played both sides of the fence. I mean, he really, even though he actually, as a younger man, had been an opponent of the populist movement, he embraced a lot of the rhetoric and even repented at one point. Yeah, if I'd have known then what I, you know now, those old, you know, those old populists knew what they were talking about, kind of thing. And again, we talked a lot in terms of we're going to do things for the workers and the small farmers. So out of that side of, that's what he's saying out of one side of his mouth. And out of another, I mean, he's talking about actually encouraging lynching you know, rounding up blacks and putting them in their place, keeping them in their place and that kind of thing. And so, again, that's really kind of the things I mean, that may be an example there, a historical example of, you know, and I would argue that in fact, the way Jeff Davis governed, I mean, he really didn't do much at all to better the lot of the rural white farmers that he was, you know, that he had pulled over to his side. But because of that tribalism that you're referring to, I mean, he was able to drive that wedge there. So, that, I mean, I don't know, maybe, I'm not sure if that completely answers your question, but that's a historical example. And again, you know, talking about my comment there about realizing and being willing to work with people who may look differently, maybe act a little differently or whatever. I mean, you know, I just, as a historian, I just can't help but imagine what might have happened had rural whites and rural blacks have been able to come together there in that kind of coalition. And so anyway,
yeah. Interesting thought. Yeah, it's just, you know, a lot of times people who are pursuing power know how to play the populist or similar card and engage in scapegoating, and too many people fall into that. I understand that. So this may help us kind of delve a little deeper into this notion you have. It's a current controversy in another direction. This involves the Learns Act, which is the law that was passed in this past year's legislative session. Our governor brought that forth. And among other things, it offers state funding for students to attend private and parochial schools rather than the public school. So it has a lot of support, and obviously it passed and it's being implemented. But from what I have gathered, there's been a little cross group resistance to that, people that you might not expect to have the same view. For instance, what I keep hearing is that a lot of folks in rural areas of Arkansas are skeptical or worse about the Learns Act because they don't have the option of other private or parochial schools anywhere close to where they live out in the country. And so it may jeopardize one of the key pillars of their community, their public school system. So do you have any thoughts about that history of trust that, you know, sometimes happens with the Ozarkers and how it might have be stoked with regard to that issue?
Yeah, you know, I think that is interesting. And one of the things I've been, of course, especially as a school board member myself of a very small rural district, you know, paying attention to, of course. But, you know, I think historically, I might mention that one of my very first historical research projects I ever worked on was a master's thesis in which I researched and wrote about the history of rural school consolidation in the Arkansas Ozarks from the first 50 years or so of the 20th century. You know, in that research and just having lived in a rural community really all my life, I mean, rural people generally are proud of their local school districts, right? Their public school districts. And I mean, it's really at the heart of the community. And it has been, again, since they've been around. I mean, it's one of the centerpieces of the community. Just for instance, the school district there where I live, just recently hosted a, it's actually, so it said, the oldest high school basketball tournament in the state. It was the 101st anniversary of this tournament over this past weekend, and it was just amazing. I mean, I don't think there have been that many people in that little gymnasium since I can remember. You know, the people that turn out for that. So, you know, the local athletics and that kind of thing. But you know. So I think that came into play here with Learns, a concern. And again, we've been down that road before when changes begin to come down the pike, especially if they're not well communicated, right, on the front end. What exactly is this going to do, and how is it going to work? And so I think that was a big part of the problem, was just how fast that was, you know, implemented, passed, and, you know, and so forth. And we'll let you know how, you know, the details later and that kind of thing. But yeah, I think especially in rural communities, because of that history of consolidation, going back to at least the late 1920s, is really sensitive for a lot of rural folks, and rightfully so. I mean, we see, here a few months ago, I had taken a trip somewhere there in the Ozarks, and I was coming along there, and I thought, you know, I'm going to take this little detour and go. There was a, it's no longer there. It's no longer a school there. It was consolidated. I'm gonna go down there and take a look at that old campus and the town, you know, there. I mean, it was a sad sight, you know, see that old school sitting there completely vacated. There was literally a huge oak tree laying in the middle of one of the school buildings, you know, crashed through the roof. The population had just shriveled up. There were only a handful of people still left there. So, I mean, yeah, that's the kind of thing that I think goes through our rural folks' minds, when things like this come up, right? So, and I think, so yeah, I think that was part of it. I mean, there are all kinds of, I mean, it was a huge bill. So all kinds of different components and pieces to it that, you know, we're still learning about. What exactly is this, and what's it going to mean down the road, especially? And so, I think one of the big questions is, you know, funding, adequate funding going down the road, right? To be able to comply with some of these changes and that kind of thing. I mean, I think there's, personally, there are some good things in the bill too, as well. But there are some things that, again, there's still a lot of question marks about. But yeah, to your point, again, I think on the some of the rural kick up about that probably is connected to that. And of course, for Governor Sanders in particular, I mean, you know, the last round of major school consolidation was Governor Mike Huckabee, you know, her father. And so I think there's some connecting the dots there on some of that. So.
Well, that's it for the first part of our conversation, Glenn, with Blake Perkins, but there's so much more to talk about, and we're going to get to that second part of our conversation with Blake in the next episode, in which he really talks about some possible ways of improving our relationships across the divide. So I hope folks will join us for that one as well.
And when you visit our website, you will see those links to all our episodes, and you'll also find a link to email us at otherhandar@gmail.com. with your program feedback or suggested speakers. Now, on the topic of other possible episodes you can listen to, wanted to pitch a couple of them for you to consider. One of those is an interview with Ryan Norris we had recently, who is a head of the Arkansans version of Americans for Prosperity. That's in episodes 57 and 58. Also, another good one to consider is with Senator Clark Tucker, a state senator from the Little Rock area, and that's on episodes 53 and 54. And as always, we'd love to hear your feedback about those and other episodes.
On the Other Hand is sponsored by Braver Angels in Arkansas. Music was composed by Randall Standridge of Jonesboro, Arkansas, and was performed by the University of Northern Colorado Symphonic Band, Dr. Richard Main, conductor.
From your host, Glenn White,
and April Chatham Carpenter,
let's each do our part to bring our community closer together.